To look at the series of lessons for tonight. We're going to do 7 lessons in total. They're going to try to take us through the entire picture of the Old Testament. But before we get into that, there's a couple of things I want to try to explain that will help us on each of the nights. Number one, if you guys have questions, like Cameron pointed out, obviously this is not our traditional preaching format. It's a little more informal. But keep note of them. At the end, we'll certainly try our very best to answer any of those questions. Your answer may be, I don't know. That's probably one of the answers I can give. The answer might be, here's a huge giant book of stuff you can read, and you can read that. But if I have a specific, very pointed answer, I'll give it to you. With that, I want to try to explain why this series means a lot to me. And why I think it's important for believers to kind of build an identity that is rooted in the Old Testament. I did not grow up, as a friend of mine says, in the pew. I grew up just running around as a typical American kid who believed that God was a thing, but really didn't know anything about God. It's really interesting in that regard because on both sides of my family, my mom's side and my dad's side, there's actually involve people in spiritual leadership, Pentecostal pastors, denominational leadership. But my family never really went to church. We only actually appeared in churches for 2 things growing up, funerals and weddings. And in my particular case, my dad did not like going to funerals. So that meant that pretty much from age 0 to 18 with my family, I never walked into a church building unless it was a wedding. Now, I did hear the gospel in a couple of times growing up. I actually attended a gospel meeting that Bob Buchanan preached in Salem, Oregon as a child with a good friend of mine who later was instrumental in explaining the gospel to me when I was in college. But I didn't have that kind of upbringing. That means that maybe unlike some of you, or maybe like some of you, my perspective of the Old Testament was very thin, especially as a new convert. There's a lot of stuff I didn't understand. A lot of things didn't make sense to me. And I'll tell you, sometimes they still don't make sense to me in the way that my rigid, structured mind likes to think of things. So with that, I was like, I got to figure this out. I've got to build a system that lets me see things that I'm supposed to see. And I want to do a little bit of that as a start tonight so you can think about what we're going to try to accomplish in these 7 lessons. So think about it this way. If you've ever watched, I don't know, say a Hallmark movie, and if you've been forced to watch a Hallmark movie, you will understand this. If you haven't, then maybe you'll get it too. But in every Hallmark movie, there's a moment that is often kind of towards the 2/3 mark of the movie called the misunderstanding. And the misunderstanding is simply this. When the misunderstanding occurs, this is what takes place. The two principal people, the woman who owns a flower shop or a bookstore, or maybe works at a ski lodge or her parents own the ski lodge, has some sort of disagreement with the man who's come back to town, who's an advertising executive or a lawyer. And it's a misunderstanding and you're waiting for it and you know it's going to happen. And when it happens, you're probably maybe excited for it or upset, but it happens every single time. And then it's exactly what's next is there's a resolution. And at the resolution, they figure out, oh, it wasn't that big of a deal. They love each other. Hallmark ending, Disney ending. Everything's great. That's what you're looking for. You know what to expect. Well, in the Bible, there are a series of events that follow that same picture or style when God is teaching us something. And I'm going to show you an idea about that before we even begin our first key lesson. And here's the basic premise. In the Old Testament, when we encounter a patriarch in the Old Testament, they always go to a well, do something, and find a wife. They might go to a well and show off how strong they are. They might go to a well and show off how wealthy they are by not going themselves, but sending a servant. Oh, he's got a servant. The servant goes to the well. They might go to the well and show off how kind they are. Look, he took care of this. He protected me, etc. So in essence, if you were growing up in Israel and someone began to tell you a story, a narrative about their people, our people, because we are connected and grafted into Israel now, that involved a well and a man going to a well, immediately, just like when you're watching that Hallmark movie, your mind would go, someone's about to get married. Now, here's the tie-in for us who also have insight into the mystery of Christ. Is there not a case in the New Testament when Jesus goes to a well and his disciples come back and they're like, well, he's there with a woman. You might automatically assume, well, Jesus is about to get married, right? If you're from Israel and you're from the people of the land, the people of the book, when your person that you're trying to follow goes to the well, the next thing is they get married. Now, what Jesus does with most of those things is called a textual subversion. They are expecting one thing, but Jesus gives them another. In this case, he goes to the well and finds a woman who isn't married, but is married, and explains to her all that she has said and done, that she has done in her life. And she freaks out because she believes. She's amazed that he knows so much about her. So he subverts what they thought was going to happen with a different story. Now, that only has that level of depth to us if we know what we're looking for. If we know that when we go to the well, we should find our dude, Jesus, looking for a spouse, just like all the patriarchs did, and just like all the kings would have been perceived as doing. Because remember, they still thought that Jesus was a king, the kind of king that was going to restore physical Israel. At the point that Jesus goes to the well, they don't know anything at all about the real nature of the kingdom. You say, now, wait a minute, what does that have to do with creation? And what does that have to do with Abraham? And what does that have to do with Exodus and David and the prophets and the gospel found in the message of the prophets or the wisdom of the Old Testament? It has everything to do with it because we are people of Israel. We are spiritual Israel, but this story is our story. And so if I want to share the gospel with someone and I want them to have the same kind of insight that the disciples would have had when Jesus went to the well, or maybe when Jesus intended to pass them by on the water, like God had passed them by and God had passed Moses by in Exodus, then we got to know that story. We have to have a framework to understand the story that they were in, because again, it's the story we're in. We're in that story. And there's a whole lot more going on than just facts, figures, and names, because God is trying to teach us grand and great things. So right now, with all that ginormous introduction, which is really for the whole week, keep that whole thing in your mind all week long. And all you got to remember is either Hallmark, because if you're a Hallmark movie watcher, you'll know that. Okay, well, I'm looking for the misunderstanding. I'm looking for that. Or if you want to use the Old Testament, New Testament, I'm looking for things. I'm looking for pictures and ideas. Like the well, and when a person goes to the well. Because when we go through these seven passages, I hope that each time we look at each of them, we're going to go, I get it now. What was not understood, maybe because you were like me and didn't really know much, I now understand better and see more clearly. And so hopefully we're going to be able to do that. Now I'm going to share some simple charts. These are not really complicated, so they're going to come across the screen in a second. Don't feel like there's a ton of information there because they're not. But they do help us guide through the process because there's a couple of key scriptures and a couple of key concepts that are really important for us to start with. But I want to paint one picture before even that chart comes as we're looking into the text of Genesis in chapter 1 and verse 1. In Genesis 1:1, the Bible opens up with this statement. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Is that a majestic text or what? You read that, you see that, you should get excited. But I want you to picture it maybe in a little bit different way. Picture it from the perspective of the Israelite who wasn't there, because that's you and me. We weren't there either. This is one of those rare times in the Bible when we can read something about Bible things and we're not the only ones who are ignorant. Because nobody was there on the earthly side when this took place. And this splitting of places between the heavens and the earth is a picture of a relationship that is still split in many ways. The earth is going to picture eventually where we live. The heaven is pictured where God lives. And something's going to exist right smack dab in the middle of those two things that is of great importance in chapters 1 and 2. And so with that, I'm going to open this up and see if I can. And you guys can, maybe someone could comment with some voice to make sure that this is right, but I think we'll be good. So the chart should be up there. You should see the story of creation. Everything looks great. I saw Cameron give me the thumbs up there. So with this story of creation, there's some steps of powerful insight that come from the text of Genesis 1 and verse 1. In the first word that's translated here for this, in the beginning, it reminds us that the Bible really is a story that is more than just a relationship of two people, two things, or anything individual. It's actually the story of the universe as a whole. And it begins in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, like I've already pointed out, with a story of creation, a kind of creation that creates the connection between the earth, you and I, and the heavens, God. But then it also eventually, and if you haven't caught this in your Bible readings, you'll note that in Revelation chapter 21 and 22, the Bible that began with a story of creation ends with a new creation. The scriptures then can be seen to us in this narration of a vast and sprawling picture of how God has reconciled all things in the heavens and the earth to him through Christ, has a beginning and ending, which is drawing us to know and want to see more. And so with that, we're going to start seeing some big things. Now, you may have noticed that we've got seven passages, but they're pulled unequally in some senses from the way in which the Bible is broken out. Our first three texts come from the first five books of the Bible. Then we have one that comes from the middle section of a text, and they move into a couple more that would be in the last breakouts of how a Jewish family would kind of segregate the sections of their Old Testament in the time of Jesus. But in historical terms, where we're at right now is going to take us from the creation of the universe to the moment when the people begin to flow forth from God's creation and do great things. And with that in mind, we got to ask a couple of questions. And one of the questions we're going to ask is paying attention to the where we are right now. Now, we're going to look at Psalm chapter 33 in just a second. But the point of the Bible being this big story box or meta narrative, if you want to think about it in that way, is that it allows us to ask four questions whenever we encounter a text. One of them is, where are we? Like, what are we doing right now? Secondly, who are we? Always put yourself into the story. And then on a more practical level, we're going to think about what went wrong. Why is it that God chose, of all the stories he could tell us, to tell us this story? And then what's the solution that's about to come to pass? What are we looking for? So right now, again, where are we? Well, Psalm 33. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth, all their host. He gathers the waters of the sea as a heap. He puts the deep in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke and it came. He commanded and it stood firm. So the where we are, and we're thinking about this again now from the perspective of God teaching us, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. We're learning and seeing that creation is distinct from God, but it is obviously dependent on God. It's separate, but we're tied together. And if you could also kind of keep this in the back of your mind, it's interesting to note that there's a great three-step picture to what takes place in creation. In Genesis chapter 1 and chapter 2, God creates, in essence, a temple. The creation is his temple. The priests are servants inside of it. Who are they? That's Adam and Eve. And their charge is to tend the temple. Now, if you move forward and go to the tabernacle and to the temple that was built by Solomon, designed by David, built by Solomon, and then rebuilt during the work of Ezra and Nehemiah, the second temple period, they all are still serving in that same temple way. They're creating a place where God, who is distinct from the creation, can, and again, remember that picture of the earth below and the heavens above, can come into contact with one another, and God can exist in a space where man exists, even though it might be separated by things in the temple like the Holy of Holies. Or if we go back to the creation, they were in the Garden of Eden, and the sin hadn't created the barrier space that we may find one day in our own lives or in others. But going back to this picture, and so you got this temple picture of God has created a temple, and he tells us in the text that the good creation reveals to us that God himself is good. Pay attention to this. This is in Psalm 19. Psalm 19 and verse 1 through verse 4 reads this way. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them he has set a tent for the sun. In Psalm 50 and verse 6, it reads, the heavens declare his righteousness, for God himself is judge. Or in Acts 14, in verse 17, it reads, yet he did not leave himself without witness, for he did good by giving you rains from the heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your heart with goods or food and gladness. From the Old or the New Testament, we are reminded about a very simple principle that God's creation is a testimony to who he is, just as much as we've already identified from Isaiah 66, by the way, that God is giving us a temple, and his creation serves in that way. I want to read Isaiah 66, verse 1 right now. Thus says the Lord, heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool. What is the house that you would build for me? And what is the place of my rest? All these things my hand has made, and so all these things came to be, declares the Lord. But this is the one to whom I will look. He was humble and contrite in spirit, and trembles at my word. In the end, we can recognize a basic truth, though, that creation is God's property. He owns all of this. But then it pushes us to a deep kind of a moment of reflection. Who are you and I? In all of this, what does God need or want of us? Well, I want to point out that one of the things that's true is that we have been created to rule the creation. Pay attention to Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 and following now. Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. So us, man, or Adam, earth that has been given life, were created to rule, but then we were located to serve as these priests in the temple in service of the creation. And you notice in the way in which God presents rule, by the way, as a side note, it's always a serving role, not a domineering one. From the picture of shepherds in the New Testament to kings in the Old Testament, they serve the Creator in their roles and in their settings. And so Adam, who was created to rule, is located to serve in service of that creation. And this is a powerful point that made a lot of sense to me when I began to think about it more deeply, that we are created in relationship. As much as we might look at that text and see the loneliness of man being satisfied by the presentation of a woman to make him whole, it was not so much just to satisfy one man's need for that relationship. God wants us to still be part of his family. He made a family and created an environment for a family to exist. It's more valuable and necessary than just that physical relationship or even the emotional relationship. So in this text, then, it leads us down a road. So remember the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey might say, creation goes beyond just making this place something takes place. And I want to encourage you, maybe from tonight till tomorrow morning, to read through the text of Genesis chapters 1, 2, and 3, and kind of pay attention to the dialogue that takes place between Adam, Eve, Jehovah or Elohim, Yahweh, and the serpent. And you'll notice that in all of those instances, it is rarely shown to us that there is one person there. Generally speaking, there is a crowd of some kind. Even the crowd might be as small as Adam and Eve. But in those dialogues that takes place, there is a battle for control, a battle for ownership. And in this case, we start with Eve. Now, Eve spiritually, in this interaction between the serpent and her, seems to begin to doubt the veracity or truth of a simple message, one that I think all of us can quickly understand. You can eat from anything except that. Now, if you've maybe reached my age, which is not that ripe, but I'm 48, there are some things I'm just not allowed to eat like I used to. And for the most part, that means I can't eat as much as I used to. It's basically that. And so I can have anything on the menu as long as I don't have too much of what's on the menu. But I'm sure you have friends and family members who are kind of living more in the realm of, you can't eat that anymore. You just can't. And there's very good reasons why they can't. And if they do, there are consequences. It seems to us like a simple thing, doesn't it? Well, Eve, don't do that. Like, stop right there. Just don't do that. Remember, she wasn't alone. In the dialogue that takes place in that event, Adam was very likely there too. And Adam could have stood up, just like my wonderful wife will sometimes stand up and say, hey, you know what? You don't need to order all that. And I have to listen to her because she's smart and because I love her. And I know she loves me. And so I don't. And so spiritually, she begins to doubt the truth of that simple message. Her trust and obedience drops. And she contemplates the tree that produces a fruit that's going to teach her about good and evil. Her reasoning for it matches the reasoning that you and I probably find ourselves doing. And I'll use an illustration that's classic for me. You see, I love tacos. And generally speaking, two or three tacos is sufficient for a person my size. I'm 6'5 and over 200 pounds. Two or three tacos is a good number. But rationally, if I've worked hard that day, four or five starts sounding good to me. Now look at what she does. She thinks about it and she says, you know what? It's good for food and it really looks pleasing to the eye. And intellectually, I think I'll be better off. I'll gain wisdom. I'll pause for a second. Did you notice how what Eve is doing sounds really similar to what the serpent tries to do later in the story of the Bible with Jesus, the Messiah, the anointed of God? He initially offers basically those same kind of things to him, thinking, you know what, it worked with Eve. Let's see if it works with this Jesus, the son of a carpenter. And physically, she took it in. Those simple verbs for us, I like it, I have it, I'm going to get it, describe that socially then the outcome of a rebellion comes to its fruition. She shares with Adam, who was with her, and Adam goes along and goes through the entire event, and he does nothing to challenge it. The Bible is going to go on and show us that those four dimensions of human life repeat themselves in every single story of rebellion from Adam and Eve through all the patriarchs, even in the attempts to break Jesus and then in the disciples that would follow him later. And unfortunately, perhaps you can see them for yourselves because spiritually we find ourselves alienated from God, sometimes afraid of him, suspicious of his message. Rationally, we start thinking through, like the first human couple, you know what, my sin's not that bad. This other person is really pushing on me. We've become basically like Eve, and physically, we give in. And then socially, we share our brokenness with those around us. Just like Adam accepted the consequences of his actions and taking that fruit, we sometimes are in the role of Adam or Eve in our lives today. Sin affects then the earth. In Genesis 3 and verse 17, that sin cursed the ground for them. And I mentioned earlier the reading of Genesis 1, 2, and 3, maybe tonight or tomorrow. You'll notice something that takes place in the curses that are given to Adam and Eve. Those curses really tie in to their individual rebellion. You'll notice that Eve is taking the lead, and her curse is to submit. And you know that Adam doesn't want the lead. And the curse that includes for him is he's mandated to lead. And you see that God's plan for them actually draws toward us a picture of how life is. The consequences of sin, even at the start of Adam and Eve, created the context of our lives and the fabric of our lives. And that sin still permeates our society. In Genesis 4 through 11, you see the downward spiral of man. There's only really two other Old Testament downward spirals that are as awful as that one. Recently, I had the chance to teach through Judges and Ruth. And I want to tie it in together because we're not going to cover Judges in this study. But if you've ever wondered what's going on in the very awful and very messy text of Judges, because it really is bad, in my opinion, it's the lowest point in the Bible. I want you to picture this. Picture a funnel cloud, a tornado, and the way in which that spirals, okay? As that spiral goes down, things get worse and worse. That is the story of the text of Judges. It starts off kind of bad, and it ends up really, really bad. So bad that people who should be serving God are sacrificing their wives to prove points. They're killing their own families in order to make themselves seem strong. That's the priests of Levi are doing that. But thankfully, because Ruth comes right after it, we get that hallmark story of Ruth, which really is the very best story, in my opinion, of the Old Testament. Because you have someone who shouldn't be in the kingdom. And you have someone like Boaz, who shouldn't belong because Judges is all broken around him, creating the line that brings us Jesus. So it's as if God flipped the switch from Judges to Ruth to tell us something great was coming. But that story repeats through Judges over and over again, the same cycle of rebellion, conflict, and deeper rebellion that started with Adam and Eve. Now we'll notice here in the text, let's see if I can scoot this forward here. I forgot to press my little buttons, so I apologize for that. I got deep into the text where I was. We've got to get to a point to understand that there's something more going on. And in the text here in Genesis, there's a solution that we're looking for. Because these stories from the very earthly beginnings of God's creation, where God is building a nation of amazement and a nation of wonderment that will be Israel, kind of starts in this conflicted ground. They contain for us, though, the seeds of truth about our relationship between God, us, and what God has built. The Bible offers for us, then, a radical picture and a profound assessment, not only of the impact or effect of willful rebellion, but God's tremendous grace. Grace upon grace, like Paul might say. That's also shown to us in the text of Genesis, because think about it this way. What was that simple thing? Don't eat that tree. Now, we don't know how long it was between event A, the instruction, and event B, but I want to draw your attention to a behavior of humankind and think, if you will, to the text of Leviticus and the 9th chapter, Leviticus 9, Leviticus chapter 10. That's a familiar passage dealing primarily with our memory as of coming. Like, immediately you think of Nadab and Abihu, I hope. But there's more that goes on there. Because in that little text, chapters 9 to 10, there's another switch flip moment. We forget to recognize that there's a space of time of one day between the instructions being given and the rebellion of Nadab and Abihu. One day. Now think back to what takes place in the text of Genesis 1, 2, and 3. It feels like one day, doesn't it? It does when I read it, even though I don't know. Now think about you and I. How soon is it when someone gives us an instruction that we go into that same kind of rebellion? Where one day later, what God has said is the opposite of what we are doing. Remember our first three questions? What story are we in? What's going wrong? That whole picture of trying to figure out what's the predicament of our lives. These have produced a problem for us, which is on a cosmic scale. Because it led me, in thinking through this text, to understand one more thing that I really haven't dealt with too much, but we'll deal with a couple more times in the text. The story of creation isn't just about Adam and Eve. It isn't just about the creation of all mankind and the universe. Because there's another part of the story that we've only hinted at. The conflict between God and the serpent, who we later learn to call Satan or the devil. That cosmic conflict still continues today. And you and I are participants in that battle today. One of the things that drove me towards trying to get a better understanding of the story of the Old Testament was to improve my perception of prayer. You see, if I only have an earthly view of things, then very often I start praying for things like this. And maybe this is you. It was me, but maybe it's you. Well, I hope that I pray, God, that the doctors that are around this person have really worked hard and they're the best doctors. And they have the best research and the best science. And whomever it is the expert in the field. That's a very earthly view of things. And that was my view because I was missing out on something. God is still God. He's still whom he is. And I recognize, and you may recognize as well, that I don't see the kind of miracles that attested to Jesus upon the earth. It's easy then to be like those who are around the prophets and forget that there was a host of angels and a heavenly army and the God who not only listens, but leans in when you or I are in trouble, when you and I are in need. Read through the book of Acts and think about someone else who was named Philip, who was attentive to his circumstances, and God listened and drew in. Because if we remember that the conflict is more than the physical, it's also the spiritual, then the solution that God provides, and that God alone provides, makes much more sense. Because it's not just about having a great doctor, and I hope that we all do. And I still pray that we have all the best doctors with the best knowledge. But I also pray that God does what God does. And if I want someone to be healed, I pray that God does whatever he can, by whatever method, because I'm not him. I'm the clay, he's the potter. See, the solution then for me was to recognize that in the whole Bible story, it does center on the death and the resurrection of Jesus, which breaks the rules. People don't do that. You don't come back, but Jesus did. And he told us that you and I can too. I think that's super amazing. And it will and can and should impact and affect our perception of even a simple story as creation relates itself to us. Now think deeply on the last edge of this. If the gospel is the good news and God's great plan is to get us back into a relationship like we had in the garden, what a wonderful place to start when we think about our relationship and what our identity is. I'm a person who's on a journey to get back to the garden. And that garden was a place that God created, a temple that then served a relationship where God in the heavens could meet with me near dust that was breathed into life and we could walk together. Now that's the picture. We're not really told a whole lot about what heaven actually looks like. If you want to read through Revelation, you can. And there's some wonderful imagery there, but a lot of that is pictures and signs. It's a surprise visit. We don't get to know the reveal until we get there. But I'm looking forward to it. And I'm hoping that all of you are looking forward as well. Now, we've got a few more things we're going to cover in the course of our time together. But we're going to start again with a reminder. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In the beginning, God created you. He created me. He's then provided for us in the story of creation a stepping stone to see bigger things, to see not only the earthly things, but maybe like the prophets of old, peel back our blinders a little bit and begin to see past the horizon. Because remember, that past the horizon, that's where the angels are. That's where the heavenly hosts are. And you look a little farther in the text, that's where Jesus, the Spirit, and the Father reside. And from the throne, they're waiting for us. Up here is just a brief reminder of the passages that we're going to be looking at throughout the course of the week. They should be in the flyers. I've seen a couple of good flyers on the internet in a couple of places, also on the church's website. But this is the big picture for the week, and I hope that this has been a great start for you. I'm excited about it. I'll tell you on a side note before we close off in this group setting here. It's 10 o'clock when I start here, and I was a little concerned that my energy level wasn't going to be where I wanted to be, but I just love talking about the Bible and talking about God, and so I'm excited. I hope you all are as well, and may God bless you in whatever you do.
Thank you, Brother Phil.